O'Connor Reel 7.
Well, when we got our troops up on either side, they were in a position then to protect our march up the valley. And we then marched up the valley with a series of hilltops held all the way up. And depending on the length of our column and how long we stayed there, the garrison of these small posts came down. It was very careful protection while they were coming down, as the same way as they had to be protected going up, and gradually rejoined the column, and new ones were pushed out in front with the same idea. So when we finally got to our objective, looking back, you would see a long series of these troops on either side, these small sections, and a perfectly safe advance up the galley, up the valley, without any chance of being shot at by the enemy. That was a method of, the ordinary technique that was used, and I think it taught one a great deal. In anticipation and getting the to ground and getting the best places to ascend your sections to so that they could protect you. And generally it had to be a very smart technique, and any straggler was liable to get hurt.
Can I take you back again to the Libyan campaign itself?
Yes.
One of the things which particularly interests me is that when you're actually supervising your operations on a day-to-day basis during the campaign, it was your practice, I think, to always move forward very much in a frontal position with your advancing forces. Could you tell me something about how you actually organized your command style?
Yes. Well, we sometimes had an advanced headquarters, but what was absolutely necessary was that whatever headquarters we had should be in complete communication with all the people it should be. I mean, it's other battalions or formations, whatever they were. And then I always used to go, leave my headquarters when I was quite certain that somebody behind was left in charge. And I had somebody like Sir John Harding. It was quite simple. We knew that anything that was any question or anything that arose, he would answer it just as well, if not better, than I would. And so that was the first thing. You had to leave somebody behind. I then went to see a variety of headquarters, the battalions or divisions or brigades, depending on what the situation was. And I was constantly able to keep in touch with them and see how the operation was progressing, at the same time knowing that communication and everything else was being looked after at the headquarters proper. I don't think there's anything unusual in that. I think that's quite the normal way of doing things. And it all made a great difference, I think, that seeing the headquarters and talking to the commanders with the feeling that they were that you were interested and understood their problems, at the same time you weren't sitting on their tails. Mm. So we didn't stay with them any length of time.
I suppose at this stage of the war, which was quite early on, one is still very conscious of the First World War, in a way, how the military commanders during those operations had always stayed very far back from the front lines and considered in the light of the immediate military precedence of the British Army on the Western Front during the First World War, then compared with that, your very frontal position with your own forces, it was a striking contrast.
I think it's unfair, really. And it's almost a myth that's got about that the commanders in the First War never appeared in the front. They did in my experience, the commanders I served under were very, very good. But when you had, as often the case, a great number of units and a great deal of other work in addition, it didn't appear that you came to any particular one very often. Do you see? And I myself think that in most cases it was really quite good. I mean, I've known Lord Haig being, shall I say, abused almost for so seldom appearing in the front. As a matter of fact, he went to the front very often. But there were about 40 or 50 divisions in the front. And the time that he came to a vision for the second time probably was a good deal of time had elapsed. And I don't think it's fair, the general criticism, that they didn't come up to the front. I think they did. But you didn't, in a way, see them so often. Yes. I don't know whether I made myself clear.
That's perfectly clear, yes. I think, again, I'm suffering under the problem of getting my information from books. And I think Corelli Barnett, in his account of the Libyan campaign, tries to make it a particular point that you were unusual in that you advance very much forward with your frontal forces.
I don't think so. It's a different type of warfare, that too. I mean, it was no good. You couldn't have, in the trench warfare, there was no point whatever in having a headquarters very far forward, provided the individuals in those headquarters frequently came up and saw people. That was the thing that mattered. I mean, I don't think that the actual position of the headquarters, unless there was a battle on, in which case you had an advance headquarters for a particular operation.
Yes. So you don't think you were at all unusual in the way you conducted
your campaign? No, I don't think I was at all unusual, but nothing would ever persuade me that you can command without going to see your people.
Mm. I think perhaps Corelli Barnett's account is very misleading in this respect.
I think that is so, really. I mean, it used to be said, I mean, that the staff never appeared and that sort of thing. Well, I may have been lucky. I was in a very good division. The staff appeared constantly, and the commanders. And in fact, my brigadier, I think, went round the line without exception every day. And I used to see him. He used to be in some part of the line.
I'm switching back and forward a little bit now,
right.
But can I take you up to February 1941? After Sidi Barani, when the disposition of the forces in the Western Desert had been altered.
February would be well after Sidi Barani. It would be practically the end of the show.
Sorry, I mean Beda Farm.
Yes,
After Beda Farm. When you were appointed GOC in Egypt.
Yes.
I would just be interested to have your comments about how you took to being given this administrative appointment after having been... after having had an extremely successful battlefield one.
Oh, I think it was all done with the best and kindest intentions. I'd had a pretty good growling all that time and hadn't been particularly well. I think the amount of sand I had swallowed hadn't helped. And it was done entirely, really, to give me a rest. Mm. And it wasn't in any way a demotion, as you might say. And I enjoyed it very much. I thought it was very interesting.
Did you have any particular preferences for active battlefield commands as opposed to administrative commands?
Well, you had... I was in the same position as General Wilson was. Exactly. I was holding his job. And one had same... I mean, one was well in with GHQ. I mean, knew exactly what was going on with the preparations for Greece, the preparations for everything else. And one administered in a perfectly ordinary way one's command. And one, again, it was very important to go and see things. Alexandria was very important. Suez, Port Said, all these places had to be seen. And while we were there, the Germans dropped some bombs on in the Suez Canal and landed there. And I had to go down and deal with them, have them removed and that sort of thing. Mm. There was always, I found there was plenty of to do, and I was given a period of a week's leave or something like that. And my wife and I went down to the Sudan and had a look around there.
looking at the campaign overall, one thing which strikes me is your propensity for risk-taking.
For
risk-taking, for taking risks.
Oh.
I have in mind, for example, the risk you took, the apparent risk you took after Sidi Barani in advancing,
yes.
After you'd lost 4th Indian Division,
mm-hmm.
in advancing with the Armoured Division alone.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And as another example, I'm also struck by the final advance to Benghazi when the Armoured Division mm-hmm. was in
yes.
pretty ropey mechanical shape.
Yes.
But
yes.
you advanced them across yes. 150
That's
miles
right.
of mm. of unreconnoitred desert.
Yes.
My question is this. Did you regard yourself, or do you regard yourself, as a bit of a gambler, militarily?
No. I would say a most careful gambler, if you would put it that way. And I always considered the odds. If I thought that failure to carry it failure in one's project made it a disaster militarily, in some real way that you a real disaster, well then I wouldn't attempt it. But what I was quite prepared to do was to be unsuccessful. Simply unsuccessful. For instance, the Sidi Barani thing, well, I think was the biggest risk I took, because it meant it was so much depended on the excellence of the staffs and the two divisions and how easy it is in the desert to get people out, losing their way and that sort of thing. Well, there were one or two things that went wrong, but very little. By and large, it was all right. But that was a big risk, but the worst that could happen was that we would attack, but not the way we intended. And it would be piecemeal and not a well-coordinated attack, as it turned out to be. And similarly, the attack across the desert, Bida Fom, that I realized, to my point of view, it was a very small risk. The biggest, the worst that could happen, I always like to think of what the worst thing that could happen was that we'd be unsuccessful and we get what's known as a bloody nose. And we'd have failed and the enemy would have got away. But in the end, we would have been no worse off than if we'd followed them up.
One of the things which interests me is how you personally reacted to the responsibility of command. I mean by that, one could in a sense divide senior military commanders or even commanders at a junior level into those who find command something of an onerous burden, which they shoulder manfully but struggle with, and others react to it almost as if it's a very rewarding experience, as if they find it quite inspiring. I wondered which category you would regard yourself as falling into.
Well, I don't think, honestly speaking, that I was overburdened with responsibility. I always accepted responsibility quite happily. And I may not have made the best use of my opportunities, quite likely on occasion, but I didn't I didn't feel terribly depressed or at the thought, nor did I feel emotionally upset and unable to sleep at night and that sort of thing. It didn't have that effect on me. I naturally was very interested, and to the last, really, one tried to encourage people. I always saw all the troops that were going to take part in the show and talked to them. Mm. And And I think they quite appreciated that. And it gave me a great lift, feeling that they were all behind you. And after one had done that, one had the feeling, well, we've made our plan, we've given all the encouragement we can to the troops, we've seen all that's necessary to see, and now there's nothing for it but just to wait and see how it goes.
Well, one of the things that I think is differentiates military responsibility from other kinds of responsibility, like responsibility in business or in the civil service or anything like that, is that in military circles, the consequences of your decisions are more dramatic. And
the question of casualties and things.
That's right, yes. And for that reason, mainly, it seems to me that command in a military environment is a much more critical thing. I wonder how you'd react to that.
I mean, in the formation of any plan, one of the factors, which we haven't actually mentioned, but it always is there, is the question of how much it will cost in casualties. And I know, for instance, that Lord Montgomery, I mean, felt just the same. I mean, and I felt a very, very very strong feeling on the subject of casualties, but I was prepared to take them if it meant a success. I mean, or it meant a chance of success. And as I say, I always talk to units about, tell them exactly what they expected of them.